I see you've been chasing your monsters and they've been driving you bonkers, just blinding with rocket launchers of light to blow.
Welcome to another episode of the Almost Awakened podcast. I'm your host, Bill Real, and grateful for this chance to spend time with you. The Almost Awakened podcast is where we spend this time together exploring community, the universe, sexuality, evolution, music, how to shed ego and work on shadow work, and tons of other topics that interest you and me. So buckle up, sit tight. We're about to explore the human experience. Welcome back to the Almost Awakened podcast. I'm your host, Bill Real, and I'm grateful for the chance to be with you today. Today, we're going to have a really fun conversation. I've got a friend of mine, Suzette, who has spent the last year in prison. And it's going to make for an interesting conversation as her and I have been preparing for this interview and the things that we wanted to cover and talk about. And what we wanted to do is ensure that the listeners, that you got a feel for what prison is like and what kinds of observations that Suzette made there and how this system works and functions and how the people within this system operate. And Suzette, by all means, introduce yourself to whatever degree you want to. Tell us whatever kind of little intro that you want to. And then we'll jump into talking about life behind bars.
Great. Thanks, Bill. I'm happy to be here, too. So I pleaded guilty to a charge of wire fraud in November of 2018. And I was sentenced in a federal court in Alexandria, Virginia, in February of 2019 to 15 months in a women's federal prison camp. I was in a camp and I served just over a year. So I went in March of 2019 and just got out in April of this year. So I learned a lot, had some crazy experiences, some, you know, funny experiences, some heart-rending experiences. And I'm just looking forward to talking to you about what my life was like for this past year. Again, awesome. I was in a camp in the federal level. There's three levels, you know, and so I was in I was at Alderson Federal Prison Camp in West Virginia, which is where Martha Stewart was many moons ago.
But so the curtains there are fantastic.
Oh, yeah, the curtains are so great. We don't have curtains in prison. Are you kidding me?
So the first thing I want to ask, because whenever I see prison portrayed, and we'll get to the second question I want to ask is the difference between a prison camp and a prison. But I want to set up the first question, which is when I watch prison being portrayed on TV or in movies, it's always that first day where it feels like all these guys get on a bus and the prisoners show up essentially at the prison. And there now is this accounting. You have to change your clothes. You have to get your supplies. You have to be shown the place you're going to sleep. And immediately there is some level of intimidation that happens that begins to tell you as the person who's entering the prison world that who's in charge and how things are going to work. Maybe tell us that first day as you enter this space, what that was like.
Sure. I'll tell my experience on my first day. However, I want to just let people know that my experience was not as common as most people. I was a self-surrender, which means that I was at home between the time I was sentenced and the time I came to prison. I put my affairs in order. I packed up my stuff. I was driven by friends to the prison and self-surrendered there. Most of the people that I knew there, that was not the case. They were arrested, put in a jail, a local jail, waited for the, you know, and so they were like either flown or transported in shackles to the prison. So I just want to make people aware there's a couple different ways to go into prison. And mine was certainly scary, but also maybe a little softer than some of my friends who were literally like armed guards, shackles, driven there, you know, and transported. So for me, I was dropped off. Now that I think about it, I think it was a 1 o'clock self-surrender. So we pulled up to the gates and I told my friends, I said, I am not crying. I am not looking back. I'm going to get this thing done. So I'm just walking in. Don't even hug me. Don't talk to me. You pick up a phone and you say, you know, my name, what your name is, and that you're there to self-surrender. And then the guard comes out of the gate, picks me up. And I did not look back. I just got in the truck and we drove into the gates. You know, and Alderson, there's not a big fence that goes around it. There's no barbed wire. it looks very much like kind of a small college campus. It's an open campus facility. Anyway, they put you in intake. I think the hardest part, because at first you're just interfacing with the guards and the staff. You've not met any of the other inmates that you're going to be spending the year with, is that they take your clothes. I mean, that for me, I think was the hardest part, because they strip you down absolutely bare naked. And they're standing there watching you the whole time you're taking all your clothes off. And it's like they're stripping you of like this outside person. And then they're giving you like these prison clothes. And when I step my feet into those prison clothes, whew, I have to say, I almost shed a tear, but I held on and I was like, nope, I watched Shawshank Redemption. I'm not crying this. And anyway, so that was hard. And also, they give you men's clothes. You basically wear men's clothes in a women's prison. And I feel like, at least initially, I felt like my femininity was stripped away as well. So you're wearing, you know, khaki color, kind of scratchy khaki pants and shirts. And, you know, they even button the wrong way, like men's clothes. So you just feel like you're wearing baggy clothes. And they're, of course, they're ugly. And then, so that part, it was a little intimidating, a little scary, but, you know, you...
Can I ask you, was it just female guards as this strip down happens, which obviously is in part, a precaution to make sure that a person entering the prison doesn't have any object on them, right? You have to essentially be searched. And is it just female guards that are participating in this, or is there men standing there watching this occur as well?
Yeah, we had male and female guards, but we were never strip searched or touched by any men. Only a female guard was there when we were being stripped. And I would leave like the visitor center, we were also stripped out after that. And that was always a female guard, but we did have male guards, but we weren't, I was never touched by a male guard. And I don't know of any real stories where people were. But anyway, that was the hardest part. And then when I met the other women, I was like, okay, maybe I can survive this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So the strip search, you take the clothes. Do they show you where you're going to stay? Are the conversations friendly? Does it feel standoffish, or is there a level of like, respecting that you're now going about to enter this hard thing? Like, how are these interactions going, and where do they take you after you put the outfit on?
Yeah, the outfit. So I would, the guards were neither friendly nor unfriendly that first day. They were just sort of abrupt. That's probably the best word. They were just abrupt and getting stuff done, you know, and the interesting thing, so, you know, after I was processed and had the clothes, so again, I'm a self-surrender, so I'm by myself, and I wasn't with other people. And so they give you this sort of mesh bag that has like your blanket and a couple of towels that, I mean, the color of baby diarrhea. I kid you not, it's that green-brown color. And they give you this kind of bag of like, I think a toothbrush, and they're like, and they, oh, you have a badge. They give you your badge. You have to wear a badge around your neck the whole time that has a little card that has your picture and your ID number. So you put that on, and then they literally walked me out the door and they pointed up this hill and they said, you live up there. You're going to be in building A, unit 4. So just go on up the hill and just go, and they'll, and I was like, just walk up there by myself? I thought that was so weird. Like they said, yeah. So I'm like, okay. So here I am all by myself with this bag over my shoulder. It was end of March. It was kind of a sunny day. And I'm walking up this hill thinking, I'm all alone. I thought I would be escorted by guards the whole time, but nope, I'm just by myself. I'm walking up this hill, and I get up to the top of this sort of hill where the housing unit, there's two housing units, and between them, there's this green area called the yard. And there's a track that goes around it, and there's picnic tables. And because it was like, you know, a sunny afternoon, maybe 3-4 o'clock. Actually, it wasn't 4 o'clock. It was 3 o'clock because they have a count at 4. And I walk up, I'm like, oh my gosh, am I at college? Like, everyone was wearing like these gray shorts, gray t-shirts. They're laughing. They're braiding each other's hair. They're walking around the track. And I was like, is this prison? What's going on? People like kind of look like they're doing okay. And I don't know what I expected, but they were just kind of living life and hanging out. And they saw that I was new, because you have these, you don't have your boots, you have these blue shoes. And so if you see people with blue shoes, you know they're new. So they were like, hey, welcome to Alderson. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is kind of friendly. So anyway, they show me where my building is. I go inside the building, and of course, I walk in, I got this bag and my blue shoes. And so everyone knows I'm new. And a bunch of women just came right up to me there. I mean, I didn't see any staff, just a bunch of, you know, other inmates came up and they were like, hey, hey, you new, what's your name? They don't ask what your crime is. I always say, how long are you here for? How long are you with us? That's what they want to know. And they were like, let me show you where your bed is. They're looking at my paperwork and they're pointing out, man, you have these bunk beds. They're just pretty, what you would imagine like at girls camp kind of thing. And they kind of helped me get all set up. They showed me my bed and helped me make my bed and just kind of got me settled in that first day.
Isn't it interesting in society, whatever different kinds of people there are, that those same kinds of people exist on the inside, which is are helpers, right? There are people who are trying to keep everything running smoothly and trying to make everyone feel at home to some degree so that the drama is reduced. There are helpers everywhere and even on the inside of prison.
Yeah, absolutely. We did, there was about three people on the unit that were kind of assigned, quote unquote, to like watch out for the new people and mentor them. But I mean, a lot of people came up and they're like, hey, do you need anything? And I'm thinking, I don't know, do I need anything? I had no idea what I needed and what I didn't. I said, well, this bra fits terribly, you know, can I help? They're like, oh, they'll get that tomorrow. And people brought me stamps so I could mail a letter home to my family. People like brought me soap dishes. They literally like put shoes on my feet so I could take a shower with, you know, flip-flops on. And it was really a gesture of much kindness when I first arrived and really helpful. So shout out to all you ladies in A4.
Love it. What was your living quarters or sleeping quarters like? What, I mean, obviously this has to be one of the first things you're introduced to is the place that you're going to be resting for this year when you're away from everybody and not in the yard. What is that like?
Yeah. So, when you move in, I moved into my room a couple days later. So they don't have cells at a camp. So there's no like locking door on a cell like that. It's more like a big dormitory. And so they call them cubes. And so I had a cube and had a person I shared the cube with called a bunkie because we had bunk beds. So they just have this big dormitory room, cement floors, and then the cubes were divided by cinder block walls, which were maybe 5'5" height. So you could literally, if you were on the top bunk, see out over the entire dorm. But as you're walking down the little hallways, it gives a little sense of privacy. So no doors, just these cubes with like kind of an opening for a door, which is great because there's no cells, I mean, no bars, but also not great because anybody can walk in your room and there's like no privacy at all. And so it's 8 feet by 10 feet. There's a bunk bed, metal bunk bed. There's two lockers, one for your bunkie, one for you. A little desk that you can write at with a light over it and a trash can. And you have a foot locker too that goes under the bed. So you can put your stuff in a foot locker and in a locker on the wall. And that's it. I was in a cube that had a window. So the cubes on the outside of the building have little windows, not very big, with a shade, you know, so you could see out. So my friends in prison used to tease me because I used to like to sit in the windowsill and like just look out. And I used to eat peanut butter all the time because it was, I don't know, protein and it was good tasting. And so I'd sit in the windowsill and like look out at the yard and they're like, what are you doing sitting there in your windowsill? Like you're in some fantasy land or something. And I was like, just leave me alone and let me look out the window if I want to, you know? So, but not all the cubes had windows, but mine did.
Yeah, I want to ask too. Like, I'm looking right now at a picture of one of the this space, this 8x10 space with the bunk beds, and I see a little counter. I see the window with the shade. Mm-hmm. And the thing I always notice about a prison setup is the bed has about an 18-inch mattress wide, right? Because yeah. Space, you know, you don't deserve a king size bed. You deserve an 18-inch wide mattress. So just to touch base with that, like how hard is it to sleep when you don't have a lot of room to spread out?
Yeah.
Probably get used to it, don't you?
You know, I had an okay time sleeping. I never had a super hard time sleeping, but yeah, it's like you can't roll over in bed. You literally have to lift yourself up and roll over. The mattresses are not very comfortable. So every time somebody would leave, if they had a good mattress, man, people were on that and they would like switch mattresses, right? So they would like run down to the person who was leaving and they were like, okay, you're leaving at what time tomorrow morning? And they were like, get out so I can have your mattress. And people were switching mattresses all the time, trying to find one that was a little thicker or, you know, whatever. But not super comfortable. And people did different things to make them you know, a little more comfortable. Sometimes I'd stuff cardboard underneath the mattress to kind of like, so the springs, you know, would give a little bit, make it a little harder. That was not allowed. So if the guards wanted to be mean, they just take the cardboard out, get rid of that cardboard. Sleeping with one pillow was probably the hardest thing for me at first, because, you know, I just was not used to that. What else? Sleeping up high. I slept on the top bunk for most of the time I was there. And that was kind of weird at first, because you're like, oh gosh, whatever, roll off this thing. But I never did. No one ever fell off that I can remember. Climbing up and down, that was tough, because it's, you know, it's really metal and hard, so you can hurt yourself. People would crochet little like pads to put on the ladders so that they didn't cut their legs. It was hard until you kind of adjust. You can have blankets crocheted or extra pillows crocheted, but that takes time to figure out. You got to buy the yarn and you got to get someone to crochet it for you. But you finally settle in usually to a like the blankets that you like and the pillow that you like, but not super comfortable, but it's okay. That's how I say it. It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The food, I'm always, you know, every place I'm sure is a little different, but I've done my own research long prior to this conversation with you about prison food. In fact, I put a Facebook post up maybe a year ago or so where I was talking about how, the government through its prison systems have tried to significantly reduce cost, and that the foods that a lot of prisons serve are really kind of bare bones and provide kind of the bare minimum of nutrition. Tell us a little bit about the menu at this place, and what some of the experiences were like with how food was handled.
Sure. I just want to say one more thing about the living arrangements, and that is that there's a serious lack of color. Like, it's so drab. I just want to, like, the clothes are brown and khaki and the walls are beige and the blankets are brown. So just want to throw out that there's a lot, there's no color in prison.
Yeah. I'm looking at that room. It's just different shades of off-white and kind of a brown diarrhea green blanket I'm seeing.
Yeah.
And there's like a yellow little countertop connected to the wall.
Yep. Yeah, that's like a little desk. So it's just I remember when I got home, like, I was blown away by how much color there was. But anyway, just a little note, that's just, it's really, really drab. Food, I thought Alderson did okay on food. I hate to say anything positive about the staff, but I think that they did what they could with the budget they had. So lots and lots of starch. People tend to gain weight in prison because there's a lot of rice, potatoes, starchy foods, a lot
pastas,
of
pastas, things like that.
Pasta, a lot of pasta. Every salad you have was like a pasta salad with mayonnaise or something. And a lot of, like, in the morning, a lot of sugar, you know, like donuts, frozen donuts that they would warm up, you know, and cakes in the morning for breakfast, like breakfast cakes. No fresh vegetables. That's probably the thing I miss the most. They usually had what they called a salad, which was iceberg lettuce with some carrots sprinkled in and tons of dressing. You know, so we had iceberg lettuce most days, but we didn't really have very many fresh vegetables. We always had a vegetable, but it was canned. So all canned vegetables, right? And mostly canned fruits too, with the heavy syrup. We could take a piece of fruit, either an apple or an orange, back to our dorm with us. So we did have apples and oranges that were fresh. And I have to say, they tried to do a fairly, they fed 800 women 3 hot meals a day. So, you know, that's no easy task to do on any budget. But we always had a meat item, like a stew or a piece of chicken or a hamburger, meatloaf, lasagna, and then we had a lot of starch choices, and then a canned vegetable, and then often this sort of iceberg lettuce. And lunch was the biggest meal usually that people attended. Breakfast sometimes, and then dinner, if it was good, people would go down. So, I mean, it wasn't great, and it was very cafeteria style, very rushed, like you had rushed to eat. But I have to say, also wasn't horrid. Inmates did all the work. You know, inmates cooked. It's a working camp. So the cooks, which is mostly people, they were heating up stuff. There was more than they were cooking. But they had cooks, they had servers, they had the people who did the dishes, you know, cleaned up the trays and all of that. But the cafeteria was always an interesting place to be because that's where most, I mean, especially at lunchtime, because all the women are down there and you see your friends and you see what's going on and who's dating who and who's fighting with who. And it's a little society unto itself, you know? But anyway, I digress. But no, the food was okay, but not fresh. That's probably the thing I noticed most. It's just not a lot of fresh food. But and they have a budget. I think they do. And holidays, they always did right by us on holidays. They always made a nice big meal on holidays. We often got ice cream or some kind of like sweet thing to eat. So, and some people just never went down to the cafeteria. You can buy food on commissary, really salty processed food, but they can, you could make food for yourself up on the unit. So you didn't have to walk down. It was probably a third of a mile maybe to walk from the dorms down to the cafeteria area. We did a lot of walking.
Gotcha. Which probably we, you know, I want to jump back here for a moment because this was something we were going to ask, but a prison camp versus a standard prison, you've already explained like the sleeping quarters are open, essentially. Everybody can kind of wander around and visit with other people in their quarters, and it's not a cell, it's not a locked door, but that's one facet. What else kind of makes a prison camp different from a standard prison?
I don't know all the different reasons. I only know the stories I heard. I do believe that they can't walk around the campus area as freely. Like they're what they call controlled moves. So they would say, okay, it's like 10 o'clock. You have 10 minutes to move to whatever building you want to go to next, your work facility, your classes. So you can't just be walking around. You have to like only move at controlled times. That's how I understand it anyway. And I don't know this for sure, but I think that the cafeteria area is a little more controlled as well. I think you have less time to eat. They might even have fewer people in the cafeteria area at once. I'm not totally sure, but I think that it's just more controlled as far as your movements are restrained. And then, of course, you're locked into a cell rather than having sort of an open area. And I know that when they go onto what they call lockdown, like if there's a fight or they're trying to, you know, find drugs or something, they can like literally lock you in your cell, what they call 23 hours in, 1 hour out. These are things I've heard of, so I may be getting them wrong, but they can literally keep you in your cell for 23 hours a day and then let you out 1 hour to shower or make a phone call or be outside or something. So we just had a lot more, I think, freedom of movement throughout the campus. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That seems like that's the distinction. How do you keep yourself busy? Like what, so on a daily basis, what are the kinds of things that you do? Either, you know, are there jobs that exist? Like how do you get those jobs? What are the kinds of jobs you get? And then in terms of like fun, what are the, you just mentioned classes a little bit ago. What kind of classes can you take? What kind of access to activities to keep your brain busy are there? So work and learning and play, what are the kind of things that go on?
Well, I'll start with jobs. So Alderson is a working camp, and I'm not sure about other prison facilities, how much the inmates work, but at ours, you have to have a job. You can't like not have a job. So, but those jobs could be as simple as taking out the trash on the weekends to working in the warehouse every single day, 8 to 5. So generally in the mornings, you have to be at your place of your job, quote unquote, around 7:30, 8 o'clock, probably 8 o'clock. So you've got people who work on the unit in what they call cottage maintenance. So they're cleaning the showers, cleaning the floors, emptying the trash cans. You've got girls down learning to drive forklifts, pulling stuff off the trucks as they come in, working in the warehouse. You've got cooks, dishwashers, people that mow the lawns, anything that's landscape in the winter, shoveling in the, you know, in the summer, mowing lawns. Let's see, there's like kind of the HVAC plumbing people where they were sort of students and they were learning those kinds of things. You could work in like the garage. You could work in the education building too and like teach classes and tutor GED students. You could work in the laundry. The staff and the guards mostly just carried the keys and let people in and out of locked rooms. They didn't do like the daily work. The inmates did all that. So depending on what your job is, you usually went to work, you know, and there was various levels of boredom involved with your working day, depending on what your job was. Or And then people move around to jobs. There's always constant jockeying for, hey, is there a place open in laundry? Because you get paid at four different levels. The starting level, just when you're first new in the dish room, you make $5 a month. And then as you go into the jobs, you make either 12 cents, 17 cents, 29 cents, or 40 cents an hour. And the 40 cents an hour jobs are pretty rare, and they're mostly down in food services, and you have to kind of level up into the top level. And there's a lot of pulling people out of those jobs, getting them fired, getting into those jobs. Lots of who got fired today. People are always getting fired or quitting or moving around, but there's a lot of jockeying for jobs and trying to get something that fits into what you want to accomplish in prison. Whether you want to just chill out for the next year, you might want to empty the trash. If you really want to like just be busy, go work in the laundry. You know, people, it kind of depends, but it's tough because you have to get approved by the staff member. You have to get signatures. And it's kind of a little bit about who you know, if another inmate can give you like a thumbs up to get into jobs. I mean, I tried to get into education the entire time I was there. Never could get in. I just didn't know the right people. I heard rumors. They didn't want educated people in the education department because they were smarter than the staff or whatever. I don't know. But it's just certainly the doctors that were there in prison were never allowed to work in the healthcare facility. So, you know.
Right, right. That's what were some of the jobs? What were some of the jobs you held, and what was your first job?
Well, the first job is the same job everybody holds, which is in the dish room. So you're working 8 hours, mostly bored to death because you have to just sit down there between meals, and you wipe the tables down when people get up from the meals, and then you run the dishes and the silverware through and bring them back out again. So yeah, that's dish room is where everybody starts. You got to be down there at 5 a.m. So you got to get up at the crack of dawn. There's always a little crew, you know, that everyone's waking each other up. Get up, get up. You don't want to be late. If you're late, whew, get in trouble. They have various ways of punishing you. And then you walk down the hill in the dark of night and start the dish room. And then I worked very briefly in the warehouse. I did work in a place called Veggie Prep, where they do the vegetable prep and chop the vegetables. I worked in what they call detail cleaning, which was an afternoon job where you like went around the corners and cleaned and kind of got ready for inspection. And I also worked in the showers. There's a lot of work scrubbing showers. So those are some of the jobs I had.
So now in terms of like the education that you're talking about, these classes or chances to learn, what access did the folks in this facility or this campus or this camp, yeah, what kinds of things could you, and could you choose what things to take? What kind of things were accessible, and what kind of real education or learning is going on?
So there's always a waiting list for everything. I didn't find there to be that many useful classes or education. What I can say about prison is you can generally learn what you want to learn. If you want to go get it and learn it, you can usually find a way to get a book in or something, but it's not, they are not making it easy and they're not handing it to you. So you can start with, of course, there's tons of there's a lot of exercise classes. There's a recreation center. And so I did a yoga class. I went to yoga every day pretty much while I was there. And you can take all kinds of aerobics classes and yoga classes and different things like that. So they did have a lot to do there. Now there was also like, the recreation classes like beading or card making, things like that, and crocheting or knitting. And a lot of people did that. I never really got involved with that. I was only there for a year and I just had other things I wanted to do. So I did not take a lot of the crafting classes, but people do. And there's usually a waiting list to get in, and you can get into those. There were some music classes, and I saw people like learning guitar and things. I didn't really participate, but there were some music classes, mostly guitar, but the inmates taught these. So these are classes that inmates are teaching, the yoga classes, the guitar classes. As far as the education building goes, if you don't have a GED or you don't have a high school diploma, you are going to school. That's your job. You will go to school. I heard a variety of people talking about whether that school was good or not. They certainly were not able to handle learning disabilities from what I could tell. And again, it's if you wanted to get your GED and you wanted to get in there and learn, you know, you could get tutors and people to teach you. And you could take your GED test. If you didn't really want to learn, then you probably sat around in school and rolled your eyes a little bit. They had classes. I took a creative writing class, which I really liked. And they had an outside person come in and teach it. And that was a great class. I got on the, you hear about the classes, you jump on the waiting list, and then they let you in. They did have a, like an Alcoholics Anonymous, it was called Celebrate Recovery class. And then they had a variety of school type classes, math, but all of it, I mean, it was not interesting to me because I already been through school, but you know, a lot of people took them if they wanted to, if you wanted to learn, they had some resources, but I really didn't feel like if you have a learning disability or you don't really know how to learn, you're not going to get very far. You either kind of have to pick it up and get people to help you, or so that's what, you know, the classes were all about. I'm trying to think if I'm missing anything when it comes to classes. If many of my prison friends are listening, they're probably like thinking, why don't you talk about this? And I can't think of any other classes, but education was closed a lot. I would say it was only open maybe 4 days a week. And you know, if it was closed, you don't go to class. So
yeah. Yeah. What about play, recreation, sports? What kind of things did the women there do to kind of occupy their time and have fun?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's, of course, everyone goes outside and walks around, and there's a lot of talking, hair braiding. Oh my gosh, the hair braiding, a lot of that. And then crocheting. People used to say you either crochet or you go gay. So people did a lot of crocheting and knitting on the inside. A lot of reading too. People read a lot in their bunks. I did a lot of reading myself and writing letters. There's a TV room and you can buy a radio and listen to TV. So you can watch TV. You can play cards, play games. Of course, the game room and the TV room are the same room. So it's always very noisy in there. And people are, you know, often fighting over chairs and TV shows and things like that. So sometimes you get a little crazy. They had sports too. Probably the biggest, most kind of fun sport was softball. So in the warmer months, they had a kind of a gravelly, somewhat grassy baseball diamond. And so the units would play against each other. And so if you weren't playing, you'd often go down, sit in the bleachers, cheer for your team. There's always rivalries between different units. Everyone knew who the good sports players was. That was always fun. I didn't play the sports, but I really enjoyed watching the baseball games or softball games. They had volleyball, outdoor and indoor volleyball. And they had a small basketball. And people would go and sit around the basketball court and cheer for the teams. And we did have a woman in there who had played college basketball and was really good. And she often did the umpiring. Again, we refereed ourselves, and there was always sort of a staff around to monitor, but all the things were basically put together by the inmates. But it was fun. We had fun watching volleyball games and basketball and softball. And then people just did the things they liked. They read or crocheted or talked to their friends or played cards, watched TV. So that's kind of what we did for fun. It's like a little society, right? It's,
yeah.
Oh, they had church too. So people would go to church on the weekends and sing and all that. And it's like a little society, and you get to know each other, and there's, you know, fights or friendships and things like that that develop. So
let's say you're athletic, let's say you want to play on the softball team, and during the months that the softball games are being played, do you have access to like play once a week? I mean, how often are people able to do the thing they like to do?
Most days, if the recreation building is open and there's at least one staff member at the quote unquote recreation building, then you have access to all the recreation. You can go down and play baseball every day. Most days, if the recreation was closed, you wouldn't be allowed to because there was no quote unquote staff to oversee it. But, you know, a lot of people would go down and practice and just bat the ball around. There was games 3 times a week during that. So I like to do yoga. That's what I like to do. And I did aerobics on the weekends. Usually there was kind of these classes, and then I did yoga almost every day if it was open. So if you like to do something, you had quite a bit of access to do it. But you know, you're limited to they don't have very good gear, of course, you know, and they don't have very good shoes to be playing sports in. And if you're a crocheter, they don't have very many different colors of yarn, and you have to buy the yarn if you have to have money to do that. And you don't have, unless someone mails you a book, you don't have access to like patterns, you know, so there's limitations to the thing you're doing. I mean, I did yoga in a pretty sad looking room, and they had yoga mats, but I ended up buying one of my own when I got some money. But anyway, you have access to do what you want. It's just that you don't have access to like the resources to make that thing very big. It's sort of a small scope. So
just a quick question, because I won't remember to ask it later, but you just mentioned the mat and you bought your own. When you exited the prison camp, did somebody vie for your mat? Like, your mat had to have been newer and in better shape than the mats that were accessible to just the general population. Yeah. When you left, were all of your things that you didn't necessarily need to take with you, were they vied over and fought over and people trying to get them from you? And
oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, when someone's leaving, their friends know about it, you know, 6 months in advance, and they're already like walking in saying, can I have your earrings? Can I have your clock? Can I have your fan? You know, blah, blah, blah. So
right.
For sure. People are definitely, and I was happy. Some people sold their stuff. I was happy to give most of it away. I'm trying to think if I sold anything or if I just gave it away, but people were claiming stuff well in advance. So, you know, and it just got redistributed, you know, over and over again. I was going to say the fan is a big thing. I didn't mention this living quarters. So because it's noisy and people are talking and people like turn their fans on for white noise as much as for anything else. So a lot of times you just hear this all the time with all these fans going so people can drown out the noise of other people. But gotcha. Yeah, we definitely vie for stuff.
Gotcha. You mentioned you were there for 1 year. Mm-hmm. What was kind of the average sentence of the folks there, and what were some of the longer terms that people were serving time there for?
Mm-hmm. I had one of the shortest sentences. When they heard me, I had 15 months. They were like, oh, short timer. Anybody under 2 years was considered a short timer. I would say most of the people that I knew were somewhere around 5 to 7 years in prison, you know? And then there were people like me that had, you know, less than 5 years. And then there were people who had 15, 16, 17 years. It's a long time. Up to 20 years was the longest I ever knew of anyone. But most people were right around, I would say, that 6, 7, 8 year mark. So that was the time.
And those that were serving longer sentences, what were some of the things they had done? I mean, obviously at some point there's got to be those conversations, right? What is somebody in for?
Yeah, sure. So there were really like 4 crimes that would end up in Alderson, nonviolent crimes. So you've got all of your fraud, white collar crimes, so mail fraud, wire fraud, tax fraud, Medicare fraud. So that was about 20% of the women there were fraud crimes, what they called white collar crimes. And that we were sort of like a little bundle unto ourselves, you know? And then the rest of them were drug crimes. So you're looking at possession with intent to distribute. So you'd be a distributor, seller of drugs, or a manufacturer. A lot of people manufacturing meth or other drugs. So you have a manufacturing, or you have a conspiracy charge. Conspiracy was what made me like hate the feds. You know, like it's like, hey, we believe you're up to something and we can't totally prove it. So we're going to hit you with conspiracy because we think that you're doing this, and it just sticks. You can just go in. Or if you're like, if your boyfriend is selling drugs and that you know about it, you can go in for conspiracy. So it's kind of being involved with drugs. Anyway, so those, and the longer sentences were probably manufacturing. And also if you had a criminal past. So if you've been in prison before, when you are sentenced, you're given a set of points. And the higher your points are, the longer your sentence is going to be. And so you get extra points for, let's say you have a gun enhancement. You weren't using a gun, but you had a gun with you. Your points are going to go up. If you have a criminal past, your points are going to go up. And different crimes have different points to them. And so those people that are serving longer are people that have criminal past, maybe had a gun enhancement, or had other or multiple charges. Let's say you had a manufacturing charge plus you have a conspiracy charge. You know, you would have more points.
Makes sense. Yeah, you talked about the braiding of hair, and I find that interesting only because being interested in human behavior, having read Sapiens by Yuval Harari, and civilized to death by, I think it's Christopher Ryan, I think is his name. And as I read these books, the discussion is what separates humans from primates and the rest of primates, the you know, chimps, orangutans, gorillas, all the monkey, members of the monkey families, right? And the reality is that monkeys don't have language yet. They don't have the ability to gossip. They don't have the ability to communicate in ways to tell myths that bind us humans together. And so what primates do is they do grooming and they spend time kind of picking bugs out of each other's hair. And that's how they build these relationships that allow them to work together. And here you guys are out in the prison yard and braiding is this big deal. And for lots of reasons, right? It's human connection. It's another person kind of pampering you. There's human touch involved, but it's not sexual. And so it allows each of you women to have some degree of human connection. And as you're mentioning that, I'm also thinking about male prisons where guys just aren't going to do that thing. So there's this lack of touch and human connection that we all as human beings to some degree crave, and we get through intimate interaction, sexual or non-sexual, through people around us. So that leads me to just kind of asking, like, whether it's non-sexual, just intimate friendship, or whether there is obviously in these groups, there's also degrees of sexual relationships going on too, to some level, right? There's intimacy that has more romantic. Tell us how relationships worked in this prison camp.
I would say most relationships were non-sexual. But we were not allowed to touch each other, but we did. I remember, so the phones are all up in the front. And I remember one time a friend of mine had received a phone call that her father had died. So she's sitting on the phone and she's clearly crying and sobbing. And so her friends are starting to gather around her and they're sitting on the benches and they're putting their arms around her and hugging her. And she's crying and everyone else is sort of like, what's going on? You know, and they're like, oh, her father died. And so, you know, the guard comes out and they're like, what's going on? You know, cause they're not allowed to touch each other. And they're like, her father just died. And they're like, well, let's go take care of it. And they were just like, you can't be up here. You can't touch her. Go back to your cubes, you know? And I was like grieved over those moments because like, I know the guards are quote unquote doing their jobs, but sometimes they were just jerks about it. Like clearly this woman's upset and her friends are like holding her and comforting her. And if you've also lost a parent or a child while you're in prison, you know the loss. You can't go be with your family, you know.
And the shame, right? Like the shame of the fact that you did something wrong. You put yourself in this place and now you couldn't be there for these moments.
Yeah, right. And so I mean, the guards sort of enforced this, depending on who they were and what the situation was and all of that. But there was definitely a lot of hugging, you know, lots of hugging. And people would be on the yard and they put their arm around each other or whatever. And most people didn't, you know, we didn't get in trouble for that kind of stuff. But certainly when people were upset and crying, you know, people would comfort them. You know, and I think that the hair braiding was as much about the creativity. You know, there's no uniqueness there. You're all dressed the same. And so when you braid your hair, not only is the person who's braiding the hair able to show their creativity, but the person who's getting their hair done is able to show a unique style that they have that sets them apart. And then, you know, there was a lot of hand-holding, even I think platonic hand-holding. And also people had girlfriends there that had a sexual relationship and they would have hand-holding. People would rub each other's shoulders. I did a lot of foot massages and that was not allowed. So I had to kind of watch out for that. But I really liked to, you wore these really terrible shoes and people's feet were always hurting. And I give people back massages or foot massages. And then of course you did have sexual relationships and those were also not allowed, but you know, people did that. And sometimes I think it was companionship, you know, and they'd like to just hold hands and walk around the yard and touch each other and, you know, in a more sexual way. And, you know, people had sex in the showers or in their beds, but they had to be on the lookout. It was very much, you could get into a lot of trouble if you got caught, but people had girlfriends and there was sexuality there, but I don't know. I never really felt like it was like it is in the movies, you know, I don't know, like being raped or having it be really crass. I always thought it was much more tender and people had the relationships that, I don't know, you're there for a long time, you know? And if you are a lesbian and you go in, then you, of course, you'd be looking for that. Some people are more bisexual or they just choose to have sexual relationships with the women while they're there. But that was the minority, I felt like. It happened and there were some relationships, but that was more the minority. But there was touching, you know, hugging and putting your arm around each other and, you know, rubbing shoulders and comforting and things like that.
What kind of punishments would happen? So if the guards walked in and they were just wanting to be an ass that day, and somebody is having some type of physical contact, regardless whether we're talking sexual or non-sexual, mm-hmm. and the guards are just in a bad mood, what are the kinds of punishments that would come down if somebody's breaking the rules?
Sure. I mean, it could be all the way from sort of like yelling at you, you know, like, Smith, what are you doing? Like, don't make me come back here. Stop touching each other. Kind of a gruff yelling at you. That's kind of a, you know, low-level punishment. They could pull you into the office or pull you out, you know, onto the porch or something and give you a shakedown talking to, do you want me to write you up, blah, 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 that kind of thing. Or they could literally write an incident report. So if they wrote an incident report on you, it's called a shot. So like you would get a shot, which is, and so the incident report would then go for review to, you know, your counselor, and you could lose your job. That's one of the things they could punish you with, depending on, you know, what level your incident report was. They could fire you from your job. They could pull you out of your cube and put you in a common area, so you would lose the privacy of your cube. They could take away commissary, so you wouldn't be able to shop and buy things on the commissary. They could take away your email or your phone privileges, so you wouldn't be able to reach out to your family. And then probably the biggest punishment would, they would remove you from the campus, and they would put you in a higher security camp. So if you were caught with drugs or fighting or repeated sexuality, they would literally remove you from the camp. And they would take you. So there's a place, it's called the SHU, which is kind of a solitary confinement area. And I always literally thought, oh, I wonder why they call it the SHU. Like, I thought of a shoe on your foot. I was halfway through prison when I saw in writing and saw that it was spelled SHU. Solitary housing unit. And I was like, oh gosh, it's called the SHU because it's literally, that's the things. But
That's the acronym.
So we didn't have a SHU at Alderson. So you couldn't be pulled out and put into solitary. You literally were removed and often taken up to Hazleton or Aliceville or to another prison that was a higher security prison because you were just too high risk to be at that prison. So those are the different punishments. And, you know, depending on where you were with your commissary and your family, like having your phone and your email taken away is a big deal. I mean, we do not have the internet, no internet, no phones. The only way you reach out to your family, aside from letters, would be to call them on the phone or send them an email through this very clunky sort of email. It wasn't internet based. It was like just an email system, you know? And if you had that taken away, you know, that really sucked. I mean, it's just, their resources are so tight and so small that these kinds of punishments made a big deal. You know, they were a big deal. Now you could have your room searched. So let's say you were just like always, the guards were like, you're always in trouble. You're always late. You're always in this stuff. They could just say, I'm sick of you, Smith. And they could go shake your room down, which would mean they'd just search your room to look for any kind of contraband, just pull your mattress apart, rip everything out of your locker, and just kind of looking for contraband. And then you have to clean it up. If they found contraband, they could write you a report. Like I said, they could go anywhere from an incident report, which means you would have to go before your case manager and receive whatever punishments, you know, that you're doling out. You know, and everyone, of course, was like, oh my gosh, you got a shot. Like, what happened? You know, what'd you get? And sometimes people would waive it and say, we're just going to let it go. And then sometimes they would follow through. And punishments, of course, weren't delved out in any kind of level of consistency. I don't know if we want to get into like the relationships between the power dynamic between guards and inmates, but the level of inconsistency plays into that power dynamic. You know.
Yeah, so. I definitely do want to talk about that here at some point. So let's not get through the end of this without talking about that. And I think we'll hit some of this in the next section. I guess you've got a little note here about like types of crime. I guess I want to start off by saying this question, which is, what are some of the things that, you know, did you ever get in trouble, and did it ever escalate to the point of you losing your job there, or getting, you know, screamed at, or whatever other things are going on? Were some of those things that you experienced firsthand?
I never got a shot while I was at Alderson, but sometimes that was just pure luck. I feel like for me, I stumbled into making mistakes more than I made them on purpose. One of the funniest things that, well, it wasn't funny to me, but it was funny to the other inmates, is I just lived on the outside for so long, I forget. So I had a commissary shopping day at 6:30 a.m. one day, and I had been working in the kitchen, so I didn't realize that the campus was literally closed until 6:30 because I'd been getting up at 5 o'clock and going down to work. So I was like, okay, I don't have to go to work anymore but at that job, but I'm going to get up at 6:15 and I am going to get down to that commissary line so I don't have to wait for an hour. So I bust out and I walk down there, and I'm halfway down to commissary. I look around and I'm like, oh my gosh, there's nobody out here. I don't think I'm supposed to be out here. There's nobody here. And I realize in my mind, I'm like, I don't think the campus is open. Now, I could get an escape charge, which is like an extra 5 years if you try and escape. Ooh. For leaving the dorm building before 6:30. But I was literally in my mind just thinking, I just need to get down to commissary. I don't have to wait in line. And my friends were like, they called me Susie. They're like, Susie, I cannot believe you busted out of here at 6:15 and no one stopped you. So I kind of like got down to commissary and literally just like hid in the corner of the steps with my head down and waited until 6:30 when the campus opened. But so it's stuff like that that I would do sort of unknowingly. But had I been caught doing that, for example, most likely they would have not given me an escape charge because I would have said, hey, I didn't know. Like, I was just trying to get to commissary, blah, blah, blah. They may have written me up and given me a shot, you know, and then I would have lost commissary or something. For I would be what they considered out of bounds. So I was somewhere I wasn't supposed to be. I was outside the unit before the campus was open. So you're called out of bounds. I did not get caught on that occasion, but you know, you can get in trouble. You could potentially get an escape charge. It would be unlikely, probably on my first offense, they would have given me an escape charge, but you know, that's possible. For me, I did get a lot of yelling at. So during count time, so they counted us 7 times a day. And at 4 o'clock and 9 o'clock were what they call standing counts. So you have to be at your cube door standing silently while the guards walk through and count everyone. And count is important because they want to know if everyone's where they're supposed to be. So the guards had walked by. And I sat down in a chair and was just waiting for them to clear the count. So I was, you're technically supposed to be standing, but the guards had already walked by and counted me. So I had just sat down in my chair and I was just sitting there waiting for the count to clear before I could leave my cube. Well, for whatever reason, the lieutenant that was on that day walked down the aisle behind and I heard the keys coming. So I jump up and stand up in the doorway, but she saw me sitting. So afterwards she walked by and she goes, "You on the porch." I was like, oh crap, the lieutenant, you know? So you go out there and you're in your pajamas, right? You're in your brown pajamas and it's more of a kind of embarrassing. So you're standing there with the lieutenant who's in the white shirt and the two guards are there. And she's like, "Smith, why were you sitting down during count?" And I'm thinking, what do you say to that? You know, I'm like, I apologize. You know, I should have been standing. I go, no, what do you say? Like, why were you sitting? I don't know, because I'm bored to death and because I was already counted. And so she's like, "You need to apologize to these officers for, you could have messed up their count and then their jobs are on the line." And I was like, really? This is really overdramatic here. In my mind, I'm thinking this, but you don't say that because if you sass them, then of course they can, you know, give you a shot and you could be punished. So I turn and I'm like, "Officers, I apologize for sitting down on your count. I'll never do it again." You know, and she's like, "That's right. You won't do it again. This is just a stupid camp. If you were in a FCI, you would be in the shoe right now," you know, and they just kind of make a big deal about it. And of course, everyone's like, "Oh crap, Smith, you know, Smith," or because they called me Susie and the guards called me Smith. They're like, "She's out on the porch. I wonder what's happening." And so everyone's waiting for you to come back. So, and the same thing happened to me a lot in the cafeteria because I was very social. And so I would like move around from the tables and like, here comes the lieutenant. She had it out for me. I'll tell you. And she'd be like, "Smith, this is not your own personal social hall. Get out." You know, and they kind of, for me, I got yelled at more. And I was, you know, I got searched a few times, but I never got caught doing anything that would really give me a shot. But I saw other people, a lot of humiliation. I felt like it was humiliation where they kind of pull you out, they yell at you in front of other people, or they pull you into the office. And depending on their mood and if they like you or don't like you, you know, they can, like I said, give you punishments. But that was kind of how it was for me. I didn't really get into a lot of trouble.
Gotcha.
I did get a tattoo, but I never got caught. If I got caught, the other thing they can punish you with is they can give you more days in prison. So if I'd gotten caught with my tattoo, I could have gotten more days in prison.
What did you get? Okay, we'll just move on. Next question.
So you're not supposed to get prison tattoos, but I was like, I don't know anyone who's ever been to prison. By the grace of God, may I never go back to prison. I got to take it for the team, right? You got to get a prison tattoo in prison, right? That's what you have to do it. So I got one. I have it. It's on my back, and it's an A. It's an A with, it has bars and bricks in it and a little flower and a cloud. And it stands for Alderson. And I wanted to be reminded of the bricks and the bars and the beauty, so I can remember the beauty within the confinement. It also is a throwback to the Scarlet Letter. And it also stands for awesome, you know, authentic.
I love it. So. I love it. Tell us, so you've got a little note here, the types of crime at Alderson.
Yeah.
And the types of women at Alderson. So let's go through those. But I'm also curious, kind of in that question, are there hierarchies in terms of the prisoners? Again, a lot of our experience as human beings is male prisons and how those are portrayed in movies and TV shows. And the hierarchies that exist based on what kind of crimes people commit. So if somebody is a child predator of some sort or hurts children, and that's why they're in prison, they are the scum of the ladder, right? Mm-hmm. And certain crimes put people in a higher hierarchy. How did those kinds of things work where you were at? And then the point you wanted to make, which is what kind of crimes exist inside and what types of women exist in these prison camps?
Sure. Like, I already kind of mentioned the different types of crimes that got you there. I'm trying to think where I want to go. So the hierarchy, I felt like this is just very anecdotal. If my prison friends are listening, they're probably like, wasn't like that. But this is how it seemed to me. The white collar criminals, the fraud crimes, really, to me, felt like not really part of the hierarchy very much. They tended to be more educated, and I don't know, they just really were not involved with drugs, and not that often. And so, I don't know, they just sort of were kind of an animal unto themselves. As far as the women that are there, so we're in West Virginia, so people who are there are coming from Kentucky, Tennessee, North Carolina, Virginia, West Virginia, most of them. I mean, there are some other places too, D.C., Pennsylvania, but that's where most of them are. And so I would say the racial mix was maybe 40% white, 40% black, and 20% Hispanic. And I would say the white collars were probably 80% white and 20% black. And then the rest would be drug crimes. And to me, the drug hierarchy carried over into the prison hierarchy. There weren't really any gangs that I was aware of at Alderson, but some of the gang affiliations from the outside, particularly in the Hispanic gangs, those allegiances carried into the prison, right? So if you were in a gang on the outside, you probably had those allegiances when you came in. But I never really noticed any gangs on the inside like you hear about. And there may be those in other prisons. But to me, it was like the drug hierarchy carried over into the prison. So if you had a longer sentence, it probably meant that you were a bigger deal in the drug world. If you had a shorter sentence, there was a high potential you were a snitch. Snitches were the lowest on the rung. And I didn't have any snitches on my case because I wasn't a drunk, but most people that were in there for drugs had a snitch on their case. And so snitches were super low on the rung. So if you were known to be a snitch, I always felt like people kind of looked down on you a little bit. And you never wanted to be known as a snitch, but like if you had a long sentence, I think it just signaled to other people that you knew what you were doing when it came to drugs or you'd been around the block. And then I felt like the people who were the most likely to like really hurt you or fight with you would be were people that were more quiet. I mean, there was a lot of young girls in there running their mouth constantly. People were always swearing and yelling at each other and running their mouth. Those people weren't as scary to me because they were so obvious, you know, they were just, but then there were some people that were a little more quiet and I was like, whew, I would not want to tangle with that person. You know, they would have seemed to bash your head against a bathroom wall. And there certainly were fights and there was violence, but it was fairly tamped down. And I made some fortunate alliances pretty early on. I mean, if somebody had your back and they were known to, you know, known to take care of business, then you were kind of under their wing. And I made a friend with a girl named Cookie really early on. And she was a girl from Kentucky and she meant business, you know. And so I feel like I sort of was under her wing a bit. And there was one girl early on that bullied me a little bit and I never got hit or anything, but I think she could have come after me or hit me, but she didn't like me for whatever reason. But I was under the wing a bit. And so anyway, that's, I feel like the drug hierarchy translates into prison as the prison hierarchy. But if you kind of laid low, most people wouldn't fight with you. You had to be in their face and be poking the bear and be bugging them. And then they're, a lot of verbal fighting first before the fist started swinging. So yeah, that's what yeah. I'd say.
And you mentioned types of women. Is that kind of what we've talked about, kind of cover it? Or is there something else you wanted to add to that kind of idea?
I feel like I met some very different types of women. Like I would say like the rural poor whites. I had not had a lot of interaction with them in my lifetime until I went to prison. And I met a lot of, I would say rural poor white people, with serious, serious lack of resources, unbelievable lack of resources. Racially, I think we were very self-segregated. I made friends with the black women as well. Like, I felt like I was friendly with them. And it was harder for me to identify sort of their socioeconomic space because I'm not as familiar with black women as I am with white women. But I would say that a lot of people came from backgrounds that had very poor resources, just lack of education, lack of family cohesion, lack of money, just a lot of lack of resources, lots and lots of lack when it came to resource, health, dentistry, a lot of lack in those areas. So those are the types of women I met. The verb conjugation was ridiculously awful. I never got used to that. Oh, it was just terrible. I had a really hard time with that. So.
Gotcha. Let's start talking about a little bit about the struggles that that happen on the inside. Let's start off with kind of the relationship between those serving a sentence and the staff or guards and mm-hmm. what you saw as healthy or unhealthy in those interactions.
I thought in general, the interactions between the staff and guards was pretty unhealthy with the inmates. And most of that was because of the power dynamic that existed between them. I mean, obviously the guards and the staff had all the power and we had none of the power, but not only did we not have any power, we had extreme lack of resources. And I just feel like that kind of a power dynamic isn't good for anyone, right? To be able to have 100% authority and power over another person and be able to fire them from their job, get them in trouble, make their life harder or make their life easier, it's not great. All the guards and staff were, I would say 90% white. We were in West Virginia. And so this leads to, I feel like the only way to get what you want if you're a prisoner and resources are slim is to manipulate and lie and coerce and cajole and try and figure stuff out. So you're not acting in a very trustworthy way. And the guards know this. They don't want to get taken advantage of, but they don't know how to help you anyway. And they probably don't want to, so they can get sucked in. So the dynamic was always more about pulling one over on the guards, and the guards are always trying to catch you. And I think also probably the most unhealthy thing that I saw was the infantilization. The infantilization was immense. So you're treating these women, not like prisoners, but like children. Like you're treating grown women like children. Like you'd come out, if we were making too much noise, like it's 7 o'clock at night and we're just up and we're laughing and talking, and the guard would come out and be like, shoo, get back to your cubes. You guys are making so much noise. You're driving me crazy. Well, that's something you would say to a child. And like, we are in our house. We are in our house and we're all talking together, and someone has the power to come and shoo us back to our rooms because we're making too much noise. And so I feel like that's just not good. Like, we know who's in charge. We know you're in charge. If you, Bill, have a boss at work, you know he's in charge. He doesn't have to yell at you and tell you you're stupid or tell you to go home or any of those things. You still know he's in charge. He can treat you with respect, and you can have this relationship as respectful and still know that he's in charge. I never saw that kind of respect. And so that is one thing I feel like sets prisoners and inmates up really poorly to come back into society, because they have no modeling of what it's like to live in a social hierarchy where clearly someone's in charge and someone's not in charge, without this level of disrespect or fake, what I would call fake respect. And so you're like literally waiting in lines like school children. You're eating with plastic silverware on plastic trays, and you're just, and there was a lot, the inmates would like have a lot of baby talk between them. And I feel like we were just treated as if we were little kids. Now, if you were to pull a guard on here, they might say, well, if you act like a child, I'm going to treat you like a child. And certainly some of us acted like children, but there was no modeling for appropriate, respectful interchange. And I feel like that was really socially damaging. And I was really stunned by it when I first got there. And then I kind of got used to it. But just the way, like even asking a question, I can remember when I was first there, I was trying to get a prescription filled. You wait in line forever and you got to be in the right line at the right time. Oh, it's so frustrating because you got to figure out all the lines. And I said, they didn't have my prescription. So I said, should I wait? Like questioning, like, well, should I just sit out here in the waiting room and wait? Are you going to fill it? You know, I didn't know how this worked. And I think the guard misunderstood me. And he's like, let me tell you something. In this environment, I tell you what to do. You don't tell me what to do. I was like, whoa. I was like, I'm just asking, should I wait for this prescription? He's like, no, come back at one. You know, you have to get back in line at a different time. And so when you're learning all those things, and you irritate people because you're saying, well, should I wait for it? Because if I was at Giant grocery store waiting for my prescription, I'd say, well, let's get some groceries and I'll come back in 20 minutes. That's not how it works. You get back in line, and you get back at line at the time we tell you to get back in line. So I feel like that kind of infantilization and that sort of like inability to help yourself. Like you don't know, when am I supposed to pick up my prescription or how can I be seen by a doctor? You have no ability to like help yourself move forward because you just hit these blockades constantly and there's no respect or knowledge. That was kind of a long-winded thing, but I think that to me was the hardest part. I'm sure it's worse in other prisons because we had more freedom in a camp. But there's no way to help yourself because you don't have any information. You don't know how to help yourself. So that's really hard.
Yeah. So, you know, as female prisoners, you're obviously to some extent kind of a vulnerable group. And one of the things I would worry about are that these male guards specifically are maybe abusing that vulnerability. And is there any dynamic there where you felt like the male guards that work there were ever acting unhealthy? Any sort of predatory behavior? You know, you see a lot of TV shows and movies, again, pointing back to media, where there's always this male guard who's, you know, trying to have a sexual experience essentially with the female prisoner. And so there's this manipulation and behind the scenes things going on. Is that reality? Or did you feel like at least on that level, the staff and the workers were all on the up and up and respectful of boundaries, I guess, in that sense?
Well, when it came to like literal like rape and sexuality, Alderson was hyper vigilant because about 3 or 4 years before I got there, the captain, gosh, what was his name? Groves, something like that. He was caught and convicted of 17 counts of rape. And so he's now in prison and 17 counts of literally having sexual intercourse or fellatio with a female inmate. And so because that was so recent, the staff were hypervigilant about not getting sexually involved. So this captain, I mean, I wasn't there for this. This happened before I got there. He was giving the girls drugs and they would come and have sex with him. But of course you can't give consent when you're a prisoner and you're up, you know, and the captain of the guard is, you know, wanting you to have sex. So
right, the power dynamic makes it unethical to begin
right.
with.
Right. So clearly unethical. So anyway, he's in prison now, but because it had happened, I felt like everyone was very, very cautious. I never knew of any male guards being sexual. Now, it may have happened. I didn't know about it. And I never heard about it. However, I did feel like the male guards were inappropriate in other ways, like making comments. Now, this didn't happen to me because, man, I was waiting. I'm like, give me an excuse to write a Priya charge on you. But they would say things like, your pants are too tight. Go down to laundry and get a bigger pair of pants, which to me is like sexualizing women, right? Like, I want you to wear baggy clothes. I'm like, we are women. Like, so anyway, they could say that. Or I heard, now this is a secondhand experience, that some of the male staff would say things like, oh, here she comes with her makeup on. You can put makeup on a pig, doesn't change the pig. Like, just making degrading comments like that about women, or how they were ugly, or how they were pretty, or how they were trashy. And so that never happened to me directly, but I heard a lot of those stories and I felt like that was always inappropriate, you know? And so I did hear about male guards sort of making comments like that, like sort of sexualizing the women or making inappropriate, what I would call inappropriate sexual type comments. Yeah. But as far as rape or anything, that was, from my experience, not happening because of what had recently happened at Alderson.
So, gotcha. Tell us a little bit about information. You make a note here that bad information in regards to counselors, and then also kind of like the lack of knowledge from the outside world. You're isolated and you're kind of hidden away for a year, and the access to news, the access to get help with your own situations within the prison camp. Talk for a moment about how information, both good and bad, works in the system.
Right. You know, I felt like we had pretty okay information about like world news or national news. I was in there at the time of the Trump was being impeached, and people had CNN on the TV pretty much all the time. So like we knew that that was happening. If there was a storm or a hurricane, we knew because of the news. And people's family would call them. Obviously the coronavirus, we knew that was happening, you know. So I feel like we get news coming in, getting news out about our lives. Like, I think the average person doesn't know anything about what's going on in prison because we don't have Facebook. You don't have anything to let them know what's happening. As far as getting information and news to help our own situations, that was really, really tough. So everybody, of course, wants to get out. And they're always trying to find ways to write to a lawyer, write to a judge, to figure out when they're leaving. And that was really hard. And I actually do blame the staff for this inability. I'll give you my example to kind of show you how this worked across the board. So everybody's got a different situation. For me, I wanted to get on a program called Federal Location Monitoring. It's called FLM, which means I could have left the prison 2 months earlier, got an ankle monitor through the Federal Location Monitoring and gone home and stayed on home confinement for 2 months rather than being at Alderson. So that's what I wanted to have happen. But I did not know how that worked. Like, how do I apply for that? So I go into my counselor and I say, how do I apply for FLM? And she's like, we can't apply for that. That's not a thing. And then I have to leave. I'll be like, okay, well, I'm getting these, like, people are talking about FLM and I don't know how it works. So I'd have to write to my sister, or my mom, or my friend and say, can you look up some FLM stuff and like mail it to me? So then I'm getting kind of information. They printed off the internet or they've made a phone call on my behalf and they're sending it to me in the prison. And I'm like going to yoga class and saying, I got this. And someone else going, I got this about FLM. We're trying to piece it together. Like, how does this work? And everything that I was reading said, your counselor in the prison has to apply for this on your behalf. So I get back in line. Yeah, and go and see the counselor again on the correct day at the correct time. And I say, hey, I've been reading about FLM and it says that you're supposed to apply for it on my behalf. Well, I don't know what that is all about. That's not right. I'm like, okay, so how can I apply for it? We don't have anything to do with that here. I'm thinking, so I'm standing there and I'm thinking, you can't leave this room without getting more information. So I'm like, I really think that you're supposed to apply for this. Smith, I don't think you understand how these things work. And I said, absolutely, I do not understand how these things work. Will you please tell me how it works, right? You're just getting nowhere. So then you go to your team meeting, which is like every 6 months, you go to this team meeting where your counselors are. And of course, I've been calling my probation officer, my family, and they're calling the prison. So my counselor is ticked because everyone's been calling her trying to. So I get into this meeting and she's just glaring at me. She goes, having your probation officer calling me does not help this situation. And I'm thinking, well, what does help? Tell me what helps. I want to help myself. And so she's angry because I'm making letters and phone calls trying to get news and they're calling her and she doesn't know or she doesn't want to find out. I'm thinking, you have the internet and you have a phone. Just call the people and tell me how to do this. So this is, and I'm only there for a year, right? So this all takes months and weeks because you've got to go into the counselor. Then they're off, they're on vacation the next week. So then you got to call your mom. Now hopefully she'll call this person to mail you this. Then you go back into the counselor's office. So just me, who has a lot of resources, just trying to figure out how to get onto one program was nearly impossible. And of course they don't want to help me because I'm driving them crazy. I'm coming in there every week trying to figure this thing out and they're telling me to go away anyway. And so then I got denied for the FLM program, but I didn't know why. So I was like, well, can I be reconsidered? And why did I get denied? Is there not enough staff? And for me, it was not that big of a deal because I was going home in 2 months anyway. And I just stayed until my release date and it was not a big deal. But for other people who are in there for 14 years and they're trying to get compassionate release or they're trying to figure something out, they're going through the same process. They're going into the counselor, they're going to their team meeting and they're asking questions and they don't get the information or they get a tiny piece of information. They're trying to beg the people on the outside to add information to it. So it's just this constant cycle of trying to figure out how to get this information and not pissing someone off, talking to the right person. You're trying to get information from other inmates who are doing it and they're giving bad information. So it's just bad information on top of bad information. And I just feel like if we had more information on how to help ourselves, many inmates would, if they had counselors who were actually trained as counselors and who could spend time with you and say, hey, I see that you want to get compassionate release, or I see that you want to apply to your judge to have your this part of your judgment or your gun enhancement dropped. Let me show you how to do that. But we don't have that. So that's just an example, a very simple example of what happened to me. And, you know, compound that by people who don't have resources, who are not very well educated, who can't read and write very well, who aren't getting information from their case managers and who are locked up away from their families for 14 years, for 10 years. It just compounds the situation, you know? So yeah. I really felt like that was really lacking. That was a real lack.
Is it what you just explained, this trying to essentially work through the system to have your sentence or accommodations adjusted, is that the kind of thing you mean when you say, like in your notes here, lack of information or lack of knowledge from outside communities? Or is that something different? That's kind of what you mean.
Yeah,
it's so hard to get help.
It's so hard to get help. And even let's say you get assigned to a halfway house. You're like, great, I'm going home. But you want to know what the rules are at this halfway house. How do you get the rules to this halfway house? Well, you have to get someone on the outside to call them or mail something into you. You try and go down to the resource center, which is sometimes open, sometimes not open. And you have to thumb through these books, which could be up to 10 years old. And you can't even get the rules to know what you're supposed to have. Are you supposed to get a job? Can you have a cell phone? Can you not have a cell phone? Any of those informations from outside communities, like when you get out, where are you going to live? Where are you going to get a job? If you want to try and start that process while you're in prison, you don't have any information. So that's kind of what I mean. Like there's just very little information coming in from the communities. And the thing that I find hard is that I was at a camp. So these women, if society wants to reform people and bring them back into society, these camps are the best chance they have of bringing people back into a society to be productive. But we have no tools and how to do that until we get to the outside. And so it would just, if we had more information, or if we even had the internet, which, okay, I get that there's going to be complications there, and we're supposed to be being punished and being separated. And But we can't come back into society as productive individuals if we don't have resources or information on how to do that.
Right. So. If the goal is rehabilitation, if the goal is to reduce future crime, if the goal is to increase the productivity of these humans when they go back into society, we're not doing a very efficient job of it. I hear you. Yeah. In this section, you kind of got a few things that are they seem tangential, which is children. And then I assume by money and jobs, if we've already covered that earlier, great. But if you're talking about once someone gets on the outside, certainly go into that. And then racism maybe inside the prison, those three areas. What are some of your thoughts there?
So, you know, one of the things I found really interesting that I didn't expect to know about is that there are children involved, because I was in a women's prison, and 90%, I would say, and this is just anecdotally, these women have kids. They have children at home, and they love their kids, and they want what's best for their kids, and they've made a choice for whatever reason they're now in prison. So they're worried about their kids. And then I started thinking, well, what is going on with their kids? And then I think, well, as a society of people, we've now incarcerated so many women. Now, what do we do with their kids? Some of them go into foster care. Some of them are being raised by family members. There's a whole variety of things that happen to these children. But it just made me start really thinking about what is going on with the kids of incarcerated women. And I know with men have kids too, but I was not in a men's prison, so I didn't think about it as much. And most of the stories were just heavy on my heart, because these women, they want good things for their kids. And every situation is different. Sometimes they gave their kids up for adoption. Most of the time they didn't want to, but then there's all court things going on. And I guess what I wanted to say is, just so people could hear, is that there are a lot of children involved in these situations. So every story I'm telling about a woman, there are kids attached. And it really made me start thinking, what is best for our society? How much do we want to lock people up? And why do we want to lock them up? And what's best for everybody, because there are kids. Anyway, I just wanted to put it out there. I don't know all the answers, but there's kids attached to every one of these women. And then as far as money and jobs, I actually did want to talk a little bit about the money and jobs inside the prison. Because money buys resources, and that money is just always tight. If you want to call home, if you want to buy anything to help yourself, if you want to send an email, it all costs money. And you're making 17 cents an hour. So your paycheck every month is, what, $27-ish? And that's just not very much money. And they're stamps. You have to buy stamps, you have to buy envelopes, you have to buy pens, you have to buy paper. And I was lucky. I did have some friends on the outside who sent me money, and that really helped a lot. They sent me books, sent me all kinds of things, and I could buy stamps and things like that. But I also don't think we realize the funds are just really, really limited. Now, add on top of that if you have a white collar crime and you have restitution, you have to pay restitution while you're in prison. And so your entire paycheck could potentially go to restitution. Then you'd have no money. And so it's just, I'm not saying that people shouldn't pay restitution. I absolutely think we should pay restitution. You know, that's part of what I'm doing. And, but it's just, it goes into the dynamic of the rest of people's lives. If people have fines, they have to pay those fines while they're in prison. And so then a lot of times, if I had a friend and she had a bunch of fines, and so they're taking her whole paycheck, you know, to pay those fines, which isn't enough. And so that her mother is now on the outside feeding money into her, which goes towards her fines. And her mother on the outside is taking care of her kids, so doesn't have a lot of extra money. So just to say that it's just tight and complicated, and it's just hard because you have to pay these different things and you have very few resources. So I was just going to...
Real quickly there, is there ever an issue with theft? I would imagine you have all these people who can kind of roam around each other's spaces. And so if Suzette buys, 10 stamps, is anybody ever trying to steal two of Suzette's stamps? Or is everybody pretty respectful of other people's property in this camp?
Yeah, I felt like it was a mostly respect. Yes, there is theft, and mostly it was about the hustle, right? I'm going to sell you this pair of shoes. I'm going to sell you this stamp, and everyone's trying to get in on the hustle. And some people feel like I got taken advantage of, and I bought this pair of boots and it was crappy. And, you know, so to me, it was more about the hustle and probably people charging too much in the hustle. But I didn't see a lot of theft, certainly some theft, but not a lot. Resources are so scarce that I felt like people worked together more than they stole from each other. So it was kind of about the hustle.
And then you mentioned earlier, there weren't that many fights. So it seems like you're saying like there wasn't really a ton of violence. And you knew kind of, I guess, you know, you figure out pretty quick who to kind of stay away from and who's happy and pretty jovial and wakes up on the right side of the bed every day. But, did you ever sense like somebody's life was in danger because they pushed against another inmate too hard? Or did you ever sense like, it could go south here any second in this argument?
I never felt like anyone's life was ever in danger. Again, we didn't have a lot of fistfights. But there was a lot of times I'm like, whoo, someone's going to come out swinging. It's coming, you know? And a lot of the fights people knew when to, they would fight in places or at times when the guards were not around and everyone else, no one would ever, that's not true. Lots of people would not report it. There were definitely people who would report it, but many people just wouldn't say anything. They'd see it happen and just let them fight it out. I've often said since I've been home, I said, you know, one thing I learned in there was I never will judge the book by its cover in the ability to people to be kind and gracious to one another for whatever package they come in. And I also will never put it past someone that looks very docile to smash your head against a bathroom wall if you provoke them, you know? So people could escalate really fast, really fast. And so you just, if you provoke people, they will come at you. But I didn't see a lot of fights. Some, it was always very exciting.
What would be the motive in reporting a fight that the guards didn't see? In other words, there seems to often be in these sub-societies, such as prison, a certain code. And the idea that no matter what kind of happens, we don't get the guards involved. What would be the motive for reporting such that somebody was just really abused without any real deserving of it, and they're just trying to get some justice for that person? Or what would lead to that?
Definitely, I would say the overarching feeling is don't get the guards involved. Let people work these things out. If there's a fight, you let them fight it out. I would say the overarching. But if you were going to get a guard involved, a couple of reasons. One that you did state, let's say it was your friend and your friend was like hurt and you're like, oh, no, this is not going down. You just hurt my friend and this, I'm reporting this because you're going to get in trouble for this. The person that was in the fight might report it because they wanted to get the other person in trouble and they felt like they were in the right. Or some people want to get other people in trouble because they feel like they don't like that person. Oh, Bill got into a fight and I don't like Bill, so I'm going to go report him and say I saw a fight because he'll get in trouble. Or you want to ingratiate yourself with the guards. So if you're ingratiated with the guards, you can maybe get your way, or maybe the guards will go easier on you. So if you report it, then those are the reasons why people would report it if they did.
Gotcha. So you've got a section here, and a lot of the listeners are asking this as well, which is, does prison work? Do you feel like prison is a deterrent? Do you, while you're in there, and now that you've gotten out, and in your understanding of conversations with other inmates, do you feel like they, while they're in there and after they got out, felt like prison said, you know, the message was, I don't ever want to go back there again. I'm going to keep my nose clean. I'm going to do the right thing and try to operate in this world in healthier ways that keep me from going back to this kind of behavior. Does this rehabilitate somebody?
Right. And one of my questions back to people was, well, what is it that society wants prison to do? I'm not sure that society is clear on what it wants prison to do. Do you want to punish people who step outside? Do you want to rehabilitate them? I think most people are wanting to know, does prison rehabilitate people? If we put them in prison and pay our tax dollars, do we get back into society a better person? I think that's what they really want to know. But I'm not sure we're really clear on what we want our prisons to do, you know, or do we want to remove people who are dangerous? I mean, I wasn't in a place where there were violent criminals. So I don't know. I mean, do we want to remove people who prey on children? Do we want to remove people who are violent, or do we want to punish them, or do we want to rehabilitate them? On the punishment front, yes, I think prison is a punishment. I felt punished. I think the people in there feel punished because they're being taken away from their children, from their family, from their jobs, from their society. And so we're being punished for the rest of our lives. Like, I can't vote. I have a hard time finding housing and jobs. And I, right now I'm on probation. So I've got a babysitter following me around. So yeah, that's a punishment. And we keep on punishing people. So I definitely think it's a punishment. Now, deterrent to me is different from punishment. And the deterrent, I think, is very individual. If you want to go back to a life of crime, punishment will only make you angry, right? It's just, it's not going to make you humble. It's not going to force you to be humble. It's going to make you angry. And you're going to be angry at caught. You're going to say, I'm going to go back out there and I'm not getting caught next time. Because let's go into law enforcement. You know, I mean, again, I'm speaking anecdotally. I do not have the numbers, but you're picking up people. And again, it's sort of random. Like, let's say there's 100 people cooking meth in the backwoods of this town in Kentucky. And 50 of them either get ratted out or they somehow fall into the net of law enforcement. So these 50 get hauled away and the other 50 are still out there getting away with it. So people are committing crimes. Some of them are getting picked up. Some of them aren't. So once you get into this, it's just a machine, right? Like the prosecutors, they know what they are. You have to sign this, sign that, stand in front of the judge. It's a machine. And you just process these people through the machine, put them in prison. And, so I'm not convinced this is just me. It's a great deterrent because if you want to be rehabilitated and you want to make better choices, prison can be a true time of reflection and betterment and making better connections. If you don't want to be rehabilitated, you just want to be pissed off at the police and the feds and go back out there, then you won't be. It's not prison that will rehabilitate you. But I think if you want to be rehabilitated, it's a good place to take advantage of some things. They had a drug program at Alderson, which I thought was really great. It was a residential drug program. I thought they did a really good job. The rest of the stuff, not so much. You're certainly not giving people job skills, at least not in Alderson. They're not getting job skills. The best job they're doing there is probably drug rehab. So they're having some pretty good success at drug rehab, but they're not preparing people, in my opinion, in other ways. But if you as an individual want to take this time seriously, take some time out and better yourself, you can take that time, but it's up to you. So I don't think the prison is doing it, but I think it can provide a space for people to rehabilitate if they want to. Does that
yeah.
make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the listeners said, you know, if a person can't be reformed, is prison still useful? And I guess, again, if there's value on the punishment and consequences of one's choices, and that when you hurt somebody, you owe it to the people you hurt and to society to mm-hmm. pay a price, then mm-hmm. then prison is useful to that extent. But really, and again, I don't want to get off topic here, but there's a realization in the last episode or two that I've done for the Almost Awakened podcast. I've become aware over the last couple of years that really free will is not as simple as we think, and that often we are a product of our circumstances. Mm-hmm. And often we are traumatized by people around us, and that trauma causes us to have certain mechanisms and behaviors. And so often what leads to somebody being a shoplifter, a consistent shoplifter, to all the way being a serial killer mm-hmm. isn't so much like, oh, I'm just making a free will choice and I'm just choosing bad behaviors. Mm-hmm. And so punishment for a human being simply being as human as they know how to be mm-hmm. doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And when you enter the space of being awakened to some extent, it really feels like we all should start moving from punishment to rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. And if the system doesn't rehab people, then maybe the system needs to change.
Yeah. Yeah. It's complicated, but there are definitely people. And I would say many of the women who dealt drugs that I knew of were dealing drugs to make money to feed their kids. So now they're in prison because of that choice. And they're definitely not feeding their kids now, you know? But was that mother thinking about that?
Yeah. And now their kids have a greater chance of falling into these patterns of bad right. behavior too. So it seems like it's a cycle, and that often the system, which is designed to create less crime, actually maybe even creates more crime.
I think it can. And I think society, like you said earlier, needs to be. The question was, if people aren't going to be rehabilitated, is prison useful? That's a good question. I don't know that you're spending a lot of money on prisons. The one thing that would be useful, in my opinion, is that if you have a violent criminal and you want to remove that person from society to stop that person from harming society, maybe the removal of that person, it could be helpful. In a camp like I was in, I don't know. There's still drug dealers out there, even though there's some drug dealers behind bars. Some of them are definitely going to come out and they're going to be better and they're going to raise their kids up and they're going to do better jobs. Some of them are going to want to do better, but won't have the resources to do better. So we'll fall back in. And some of them don't want to do better.
Yeah.
But you just spend a lot of money locking them up for a short period of time.
Yeah.
It's a complicated question.
Yeah.
It's a complicated question.
I've only got maybe 25 minutes left, somewhere okay. in that range. I want to try to hit some of these other things. So you've got this idea of sentencing society, victims. I feel like we covered that to some extent in this conversation we just had. Do you have anything else you want to add to that kind of section?
Yeah. The only thing I'll add is that after being through the sentencing process, after being through signing a plea, and watching so many other people, it's just such a machine. You know, I used to think that when the statement of facts came out and when the plea came out, that that was the truth, right? The FBI did it. They wrote this. Of course it's true. But you realize it's hard to find out what's really true, because I'll tell you what, I signed my plea because my lawyer said, you either make this hard on them or you make this easy on them, and they will make it hard or easy on you in return. So of course I signed, right? Like, I want my life to be as easy as possible. Do I think my statement of facts is true? Mostly true. Yeah. But in every case, people are just making the decisions that are best for them. And that, as an outsider, I guess I would just say to people, like, it's hard to know what the truth is, even when the reports come out, because everybody's like, got their angle. And of course there's victims involved too. And we haven't talked about the victims of these crimes very much. And that's a whole nother question. I mean, these victims of the crimes, they want their slice of justice too. And I think they should get it. But what is just for them? And how are we helping society? I don't know. Like, these are just hard, hard questions. But I guess when I talk about sentencing and prosecution, I don't know. I just have a different view on where the truth lies. It's not always as easy to see.
No. We don't live in a black and white world, right? Like, things are messy. They are complicated. And the facts, and we don't take into account people's life experience and the trauma imposed on them. We don't take into account that they were committing a bad behavior because it was the only possible means they knew to provide for the people around them or themselves. And it really does get tricky. And if somebody has to decide between, I fight this and maybe there's a 30% chance I can plead my case and be seen and heard and go free. Mm-hmm. Or if I fight it, I get 20 years instead of 5 years.
That's
if
exactly I just do the right.
Now I'm, you know, if it was me and I'm innocent and I'm facing a 50-50 chance of 20 years or no years, or I can take the plea for 5, I might take the plea for 5. It does get complicated. So I completely hear what you're saying.
I will say, you mentioned innocent. I didn't meet anyone who was innocent, myself included. Like, we are guilty of committing crimes. So that being said, you're still going to want to help yourself. So there certainly are innocent people who go to prison. I don't know that I met any. And again, I was guilty of my crime, but it's in the nuances, right? Like, how guilty is guilty and what exactly really happened? And what do the victims of these crimes need to feel better? And what is a correct punishment for this crime? And who else is out there committing these same crimes who isn't being punished and doesn't matter? So I think it's more of those kinds of questions than whether or not someone is innocent or guilty. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, we're slicing those hairs a little bit more.
So. Right. What is the appropriate sentence for the facts as they really are, rather than the perception of the facts by 100 different parties?
Right. I'll just give one example. So I was really curious about my drug crime friends and how much time they thought they should spend in prison. So I often would ask them, go back to the day you were sentenced and you're dope sick and you're strung out on drugs and you're making some bad choices. From that day till the day you feel like you could have gone back into society and done right, like, how long would that be? I would say most of my drug friends, I call them drug friends, doesn't sound right, but most of the friends I had that had committed a drug crime, you would say 4 years. Okay, well, let's say their sentence is 10 years, and they're saying in 4 years, I moved from that dope sick person to a person who really kind of got it and wanted to do better. But then I got 6 more years. So society is losing 6 years. This is just an example of a person who could be back into society. And so, again, it goes back to these sentencing things that I'm not sure what the right answer is, right? So society loses time on a person who was already rehabilitated 4 years in and has 6 more years to serve. But maybe somebody died from a drug overdose. How does their family feel about it? You know, so there's all these different pieces. But what I want to say is I do think the sentences are too long in general, and that we would do better as a society to pull people back out, because they are rehabilitated faster than we leave them in there. And if they're not going to be rehabilitated, they're not going to be. Does that make sense? So.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you sort
that's
out?
Just anecdotally, but,
right. How do you sort out the people that need to stay longer to protect society versus the people that need to get out earlier because they're ready to now contribute in healthy, positive ways to building society?
Yep. And that's a hard question.
Yeah, totally. This last section is what could we do to make things better? You know, I'll kind of let you go through that list. You know, you've got a note here, be aware that prisoners are out there, encourage classes and programs, help in the community, and understand addiction, abuse, and neglect. Maybe run us through some of your thoughts in each of those.
Again, this is where the conversation, like, it's just, it's uncertain. But I think somebody was teasing me. They're saying, white people just want to raise awareness. That's all they want to do. And so here I am raising awareness about prisoners. But I definitely think that they're a population that people just don't think about. They just don't think about it. I never thought about prisoners until I was one. I never knew what their lives were like. I never thought about it. But just being aware that there are prisoners out there, and it's not just Orange is the New Black melodrama. Like, these are people's lives, and they're there. You know, hundreds of thousands of people in our country are currently incarcerated. And I think it's important to remember that they're there. We can just, if you remember to pray for them, I think that's a great thing. If you remember to talk about them or ask questions or say, oh, I wonder what's going on in the prison. Is there a prison that's around you or a jail that's around you? Do you know who's in there? What's going on? Could you be a visitor? Could you write letters? I mean, I think there's just a level of saying, there are people in society that are living off the grid, not by their own choice, but because they're locked up and they're very forgotten. And then the second layer would be, there are people coming back into society every single day that are going to have a hard time. I don't know. Do you have a business or a house that you could take a chance on somebody? Do you want to open it up and interview some felons? I understand that they're a higher risk population. I get that. But they're not going to have it any easier unless you take a chance on them. Maybe you want to hire them. Maybe you want to at least interview them. Maybe you want to say, hey, this person's looking for housing and they're not going to find it. Maybe I'll just give them a chance. Like, I feel like if we start being more aware of opening doors, there are some people that I believe that I knew in prison who I think really, really want to have a better life. I'm not sure they're going to, because I don't know if they're going to be afforded the resources to make that happen. You know, so I think being aware of what's just going on in your own community and where are the people when they're coming back? Who are these people? Where are the halfway houses? Have you gone over to the halfway house? Do you know what's going on there? Are you able to give? Are you able to make a friendship with someone who doesn't talk like you or look like you or have the same experience as you? I think we can do a lot to help in communities if we actually paid attention to where the prisons were, where the halfway houses were, where are people working that are coming out of prison, and can we increase their working wage? Can we give them better jobs? Can we, you know, just those kinds of things. And I understand that people want to, you know, take precautions. I am certainly, for me, who was a person who committed fraud, less likely to commit fraud now than I was before. So someone who hired me before I had a felony was taking a bigger chance than they are now. Anyway, you know, so kind of like that. But, and then I think understanding addiction, abuse, and neglect. So many of the women I met came from long histories of poor education, neglect, and really abusive situations, physically, emotionally, sexually. And so some of them come by their crimes, really, honestly, in my opinion. And to be aware of, you know, what addiction, neglect, and abuse causes? I mean, do you know where the domestic violence shelters are in the community? How, what can you do to help women who are being abused or like put, you know, not tolerate that kind? And a lot of people in my world in the middle, you know, I'm a white middle-class person. I don't have a lot of interface with poor whites or other races that I can try and do that more. I can try and go into those communities or be aware of those communities and think of how I might be more supportive or even just in my dialogue about them, not just be like, oh yeah, those people out in Kentucky, blah, blah, blah. Those are real people. Those are people are my friends now. You know, those people are really trying to make a life. And I think understanding the lack of education and resources they have before they go in could perhaps do some preventative. So that's kind of, I guess, what I wanted to talk about. And I think there are people, if you are a lawyer or a social worker and you want to go into prison reform, that would be awesome. You know, like I think you can actually be even more involved. But if you're just like a person who's not going to become a defense attorney, shout out to my defense attorney, by the way. I love you, Paul. You did a great thing for me. And I think that defense attorneys are awesome and people really do need them. And it's not just about the guy who committed murder. It's about all kinds of crimes and people need to have good defenses and understand what they're signing and what they're getting into. And I think if you really do want to take the bull by the horns, I mean, there's a lot of organizations that are trying to create prison reform and I'm trying to learn more about them. And there are tons of books. Obviously people know about Just Mercy and they've read that. And that's a great one. I've read it too. There's a book called Locked In. There's The Mars Room. I think that's coming out in a movie soon. What's the other one that's fairly, oh, The New Jim Crow. If we want to talk about racism, and I'm not an expert in talking about racism, but The New Jim Crow is a really good book about how prison impacts Black communities much deeper than others. And it's almost like the new way of a new form of slavery or the new Jim Crow laws, this incarceration. And reading that book, I think could be helpful, but recognizing that we are not all punished the same. And that's, there's a strong racial bias in how that happens. And again, I'm not an expert in racism, but there are certainly minorities are getting longer sentences, getting prosecuted more, and that's not right.
So. Yeah, I've done a lot of reading in the last year that points to that as well, that we really aren't treating young Black men or young Black women on the same standard of punishment and sentencing and consequences as we do with a young white male or young white female. Mm-hmm. I want to wrap up kind of with a last question and it parse it out maybe into two little pieces. One is that a listener was asking about, were you able to maintain your sense of individuality? Were you able to maintain your sense of worth while serving your time? So let's start there. Did you feel like you were able to maintain that?
I feel like I was, at least on individuality, I was different in many ways from people. I also had a lot of people writing to me from the outside, so I stayed really connected. So thanks, friends. You can maintain your individuality if you want to. And people do a lot to try and be different. The worth part, I think, is harder because the longer you're there, I think you feel less and less like a human, you feel less and less like a person who can actually like do something, have a dream, have initiative, because your initiative doesn't get you anywhere. So I think worth is a harder thing for prisoners because they just bang their head against the wall all the time. And so they start to feel like, what good is it? I can't get anywhere. I can't do anything. I can't have a dream. I can't better myself. I'm in here for so many years. And so I think that is probably the harder piece. Individuality, I think, is a little bit better because there are different ways to individuate yourself, but the worth piece and the longer you're there, obviously, the harder it is, I think, to hold your sense of worth, intrinsic worth. And also part of that is like expressions of creativity, expressions of goals, expressions of future. Those things are sort of sucked away from you bit by bit.
Yeah. And then the second part of this listener's question, which I will end with, which is if you could change two things about the way the prison system works, what are your thoughts on those two changes? Is there something that comes to mind that you're like, man, if we could just do this thing, it would just make a night and day difference?
I definitely think if you could improve the level of respect between the staff and the guards and the prisoners and have a have the infantilization go away, have a level of respect where they're working in a community where it's modeling a greater level of respect, I think that would go a long way, because you're going to be able to step away from manipulative behaviors, lying behaviors, worthless behaviors. And you're just saying, hey, we're in here, you're in charge, let's make the best of this and treat each other with a level of respect. I think that would be go a long way. And ability to give, I would say, prisoners resources, like accurate resources that they could help themselves, would be the two things. And I've already talked about them.
I love it. I love it. And here we are, we've 2 hours in and we've gone over a year of prison and kind of all the facets that listeners were interested in, that you wanted to talk about, some questions that I wanted to add to have you kind of speak on. I just think this is invaluable. I think people are first, we're all interested in, on this side of things, in people whose lives have unique experiences, and we can learn from those experiences. And unless we experience it ourselves, we don't have a clue what goes on there. So I think filling in voids of knowledge and helping us with information about what this looks like and how it works. And then I think the other thing is, if we're going to be compassionate human beings, to understand the plight of other humans and to be able to now, as you pointed out just a few minutes ago, to be aware and to, in whatever little small ways we all can, because if we all do just a little tiny thing to make a difference, it ends up being monumental differences when you add it all up. I just want to say thanks. It's a lot of fun. I appreciate you, Suzette, and consider you a friend. And I was excited to have the conversation where we talked about what this experience was like. And I think listeners will find this invaluable.
Thank you so much. Thanks for letting me just share about some people that other people don't think about, and let me tell some stories. And it's good to see you too, Bill.
Yeah. Love it. Love it. I'll clean this up, get it out. And for the Almost Awakened listeners, just appreciate you tuning in today, and appreciate you taking time to listen, and hope that future episodes are as exciting and entertaining as our conversation today with Suzette. So thanks so much, everybody. Suzette, have an awesome day. We'll get this thing published, and listeners, see you guys next time.
Okay.
Please consider helping us keep this podcast alive by donating. You can do that by going to the website almostawakened.org. There at the top of the page, you'll see the donate button. Click that and send a few dollars our way. This takes lots of time and prep to do this podcast, but we're excited to do it. Help us keep it going. The outro music is brought to you by Dirty Heads, Sound of Change. You can email us at almostawakenedpodcast@gmail.com. You can check us out on Facebook at Almost Awakened. You can also find us on Reddit, Almost Awakened, there as well. Please join in the conversations there, where you can discuss this topic and others and engage other people on this side of life who are almost awakened.
I see you've been chasing your monsters, and they've been driving you bonkers, just blinding with rocket launchers of light to blow out their conscious. If you really want to juxtapose and take a darker color with the blush of rose, and then you put it in your ink and watch it go, your mind is always open when your eyes are closed, because you're blind to color and you're blind to greed, blind to all the things that you don't need. Then you find a mind and then you plant a seed, then you nourish it a little.
You're building it up.
Sound. I live in the now, the sky's my home, and I live in the clouds now.